This episode is accredited for continuing medical education by CINEMED. Please view the accreditation information in the show notes. After listening to the episode, click the link provided in the accreditation portion of the show notes to obtain your CME. It is with great pleasure that I am introducing our next guest on the Reset Diabesity podcast, Dr. Samer Matar. Dr. Matar is Professor in Chief of the Metabolic and Bariatric Surgery Division at the Baylor College of Medicine. He's the director of the Metabolic Surgery and Medical Weight Loss Clinic at Baylor St. Luke's Medical Center and the program director for the General Surgery Residency Mentorship Program in the Department of General Surgery at Baylor College of Medicine. Prior to that, Dr. Matar was the medical director of weight loss services at the Swedish Medical Center in Seattle, and he served as the chief of bariatric services and the surgical weight loss center at Oregon Health and Sciences University. Dr. Matar is a past president of the American Society of Metabolic and Bariatric Surgery and the president of the Fellowship Council. Dr. Matar, thank you for joining us on the Reset Diabesity podcast today. It's a real pleasure to get the opportunity to discuss metabolic disease and treatments with you.
I wonder if have you looked at eating disorders and what role they play in this?
They actually play a small role. They're not as much as prevalent as we imagined. There are scientific screening methods to identify patients who might have eating disorders, such as binge eating disorders or night eating disorders. And these are patients who we then refer to specialized psychologists who deal with these eating disorders. But by and large, our patients do not have, at least 90% of our patients, if not more, do not have eating disorders.
Are there psychological connections around, say, depression or stress or anxiety or any of those?
Yes. In fact, the majority of our patients have an element of depression or anxiety. 80%. What we don't know is chicken and egg thing. We don't know whether it's the metabolic syndrome and morbid obesity that resulted in depression because of the many factors involved, that are associated with morbid obesity, or whether it's underlying depression that might have resulted in weight gain and then metabolic syndrome. But we do know that both are very, very strongly associated.
And not sure if one is which one precedes the other,
right,
in this case.
And this is why every program has, if not their own in-house psychologists, then a network of psychologists who are there to support the patients.
For myself, there's the sleep apnea machine. There's the Eliquis. That's not product placement. That's just the drug that I'm on. There's that one. There's a statin for cholesterol. There's the metformin for pre-diabetes and diabetes. It just goes on and on and on. It just accumulates. And you would imagine that, at the very least, as patient, I would connect the dots that, oh, wait, I'm morbidly obese and all of these things are happening. That still seemed very opaque to me at the time, as the first person perspective. I'm not thinking about my own mass. I'm just thinking about, I'm falling apart. Why am I falling apart? I don't make that connection. I'm not surprised that others don't make that connection immediately as well, that they treat, I have experienced being treated differently as an obese person than I do now. There is still stigma, social stigma around obesity in a sense of we associate it with laziness or with other negative characteristics. Overeating is just a matter of not being conscious or some variant of that. How do you help get to those patients and get past all of the stigma?
So you mentioned very correctly the long course that these patients live through. You know, they reach, sometimes they start young, but most patients reach middle age and they start, they develop hypertension. Little by little, next comes diabetes. And they think, oh gosh, now I've got diabetes. Now my lipids are up. And they don't seem to connect that there's an underlying problem that's driving all these diseases. This is where the provider comes in and has to bear that in mind, that, listen, I think we know why you have these four or five different problems. They're probably related to metabolic syndrome. Let's try and address that. But you're right about the stigma, because I fear that the next thing the provider is going to do is say, I need you to eat less and move more. And that is never going to solve the problem, because we have to look deeper into why is this behavior happening. There's no question that these patients are gaining weight, and there's no question that they're eating more, but why are they eating more? And this is because they're being driven to eat more. This is not a choice that they're making. It's like when I tell patients, it's not their fault. It's like when you've walked across the desert and you're very thirsty, there's nothing going to stop you from drinking that bottle of water. And the same thing happens with hunger. There's a metabolic problem. Their metabolic system has been recalibrated so that whether it's from stress or chronic inflammation, it's a survival thing. And the body reacts to stress by reducing its metabolic rate. And for this purpose, patients eat more. And so we have to look at the reason of why they're eating more and reverse that. And this is what our therapies do. They reduce appetite. They recalibrate the metabolic system that we have.
I'm sure there are differences in dealing with pediatric patients versus dealing with geriatric patients. What are some of those differences?
Yeah. Well, first of all, there are misconceptions, again, that we have to overcome. The first was, and I'm often asked about this, do you have an age limit on your patients? Yes. And the answer is really there are no age limits, whether lower age limits or higher age limits. I've operated on patients, I think my oldest patient was 82 years old. And I remember very well him asking me this question, what's your oldest patient? At the time, it was someone in the 70s. And he said, would you operate on me? I'm 82 years old. And I said, I would operate on you if we evaluated you and found that you would withstand the risks of surgery. And we did. And he was very appreciative, and he wrote me a letter thanking me. He said he was trying to keep up with his younger wife. And this operation helped him do that. And then he said, this was about a week after surgery, and he said, oh, by the way, I've had my first bowel movement and life is good. Now, as for the other end of the spectrum, you know, there used to be very rigid rules that we had to wait until children completed their growth. And we would have to actually verify that by taking x-rays of their joints to show that they had indeed completed their skeletal bone growth. But the new guidelines that were issued by ASMBS and that were approved by the American Academy of Pediatrics has removed that. Mm-hmm. And now there are no strict rules for lower age limit. And we find that the value and benefits of bariatric surgery on these adolescents and even children far outweigh the risks of not acting. How these children, and we're seeing very sad situations where children are developing diabetes and sleep apnea and hypertension at alarming rates, all associated with metabolic syndrome. And many pediatricians are encountering adult-type diseases in these children. And so, again, back to what I mentioned earlier, the sooner you refer patients to us, the better, before these problems advance. And just as an illustration, liver transplantation is rising in frequency in this country. And among young adults, The most common cause for liver transplantation is the consequences of fatty liver disease that are acquired in childhood.
The fatty liver disease is acquired during childhood.
Yeah,
that's shocking, isn't it? That's amazing. It's hard to see this through any one simple lens, isn't it? It's definitely a comprehensive epidemic. It's a problem.
It's a problem also because this is our future. These children today are the ones who are going to be supporting us.
Have you seen longitudinal data on pediatric patients?
Yeah, we've seen, and we know for a fact that 80% of obese children will become obese adults.
It's shocking me that it's 80%. I guess it's so pervasive that I just don't see it. It doesn't register in some way. The early intervention with pediatric patients and quality of life, are you seeing, what are those outcomes looking like? I can't imagine that, please.
So, of course, children and adolescents, they have a slightly different pathway to surgery than adults do because we take the whole family into account and we like to meet with both parents, if possible, in addition to the patient, of course. And there's and that involves educating not only the patients but the parents as well. The whole family has to be very motivated and involved in the entire process. The outcomes, though, are amazing. They are very positive. These kids do extremely well. For the majority of them, they're safer to work with, meaning that they have less risks of complications, and they because they're more active, they do very well compared to their adults.
So the efficacy rates are the same. The children are doing better because they're children and they're.
They heal quicker. They return to normal life quicker, and they do better than adults.
So no undue risks related to pediatric patients or geriatric patients.
Well, there's never no undue risks.
Sure.
Every procedure has a certain level of risk, but it's quite minimal when we appropriately prepare these patients.
I did ask you as an aside, I find this to be something that I'm thinking about obesity both in the broader sense of the population and then in my own perspective, through my own lens, I'm thinking about obesity. And I've looked at, in popular culture, we've got these weird competing demands. We've got movie stars taking Ozempic and we have rap stars singing about being obese. What kind of messages are we culturally transmitting about weight and where it fits in the world?
Yeah, thank you. This is a phenomenon, a trend that we've been monitoring. And frankly, it's not necessarily a negative one in that people are beginning to accept their bodies as they are, whether they're overweight. We certainly don't want there to be any body shaming at all. People should not be ashamed of how they look, and people should not be shamed about how they look. On the other hand, it's a very fine balance because you don't want to necessarily be neglecting the underlying medical conditions that could be happening. So in other words, there's nothing shameful about how patients look, and we support that, but it also means that they need to see their providers and make sure that there are no underlying medical conditions that need to be managed.
How are we doing with regard to the perception of gluttony versus the perception of disease? Are we moving the needle towards this is a recognizable metabolic disease, or are we still struggling with the notion of its personal gluttony that's causing this?
I think over the last 20 years, we've made significant progress. I think, you know, through societies like OMA and TOS, and also the OAC, which is the Obesity Action Coalition, which is a grassroots kind of society that is for by patients and for the patients to promote understanding of the disease and deal with bias and discrimination in this area. They've come a long way into having the public recognize that this is a disease and that it's not necessarily a matter of greed or gluttony. But unfortunately, there's still a lot of work to be done because there are still a lot of people there who lay blame squarely at the feet of the patient.
I was reading a study recently that indicated a percentage of people who perceived it as a patient failing versus or a personal failing versus a disease. And those numbers were startling to me, that what the large percentage of people, there was still a large percentage of people who thought of it as a personal failing. Yeah. It's going to take a lot of work to get over that, isn't it?
It will. But we're doing it day after
day. Awesome. It was difficult watching that just from the patient perspective. I can't imagine how hard it would be from the physician perspective, that you're trying to help a group of people and seeing them drop out for reasons related to insurance of all things has got to have an impact. What I can't wrap my head around is if a surgery with complementary support can result in curing obesity and diabetes, how can insurance companies justify not paying for those?
I'm not an insurance expert.
No, I understand.
I don't understand how their actuarial and other business decisions are made. All I do know is that patients tend to change their insurance frequently. And my guess is that they probably don't want to invest a large sum of funds in a patient's surgery just to have the next insurance company recoup the benefits. I don't think they see the big picture that we are actually improving the entire pool of lives that they have. There's no question that you mentioned earlier how patients who come to us are on have medical conditions that necessitate maybe 20, 30, sometimes 40 prescriptions. I don't know how they keep them all in line. But we do know that after surgery, these numbers drop to maybe 2 or 3 prescriptions. There's no question that the operations pay for themselves. They're a good return on investment. The calculation is that it takes about 2.5 years. To get a return on the investment, but sadly, insurance companies have to report to their stockbrokers every quarter. that's my take on it. But I'm not an insurance expert.
Can we talk a little bit about high fructose corn syrup and how that's finding its way into all of our food?
It's an interesting phenomenon that when we look at, you know, the United States Department of Agriculture, they've been collecting BMI of the population for the last 100 years. And you can see from a graph that they have that the BMI of the nation as a whole was pretty stable in the 20s, so to speak, until in the 1970s. It started an upswing, and this upswing has continued relentlessly until today. And they wondered what might have provoked this, what happened in the 70s that might have contributed to this phenomenon, to this upswing. And there's a theory that during the Nixon administration, they began to support farmers by subsidizing corn. They would promote corn production. And suddenly the result of that was that there was an abundance of corn. And in order to make use of that, they discovered that they could turn that into corn syrup. And so there was now an abundance of corn syrup, which, of course, food corporations took advantage of and started introducing it into almost every known edible consumable product there could be. And now there's a reverse trend where we're trying to eliminate and reduce that. But we think that might have contributed to some extent in this epidemic, because it does affect metabolism, the way food is metabolized, as compared to normal fructose and sucrose.
So there's actually a physiological difference in the processing of high fructose corn syrup versus the processing of other sugars?
I believe so. I'm not an expert.
That's okay.
It's just an observation that was made of an association between rising BMI in the population at large and the introduction of high fructose corn syrup.
There are some other issues. One of the issues is we've talked a little bit about this, the economic issues, that my supplements are expensive. The medications that I'm taking, although covered by insurance, they're not cheap. You know, my deductible exists. There's a real cost there. I was reading in a health economic journal that the cost of healthcare for obese patients is double the out-of-pocket cost, direct costs, than for lean patients. Have you discovered that to be true? Is cost, how prohibitive is cost? Yeah.
Yes, when you see how patients come to us with chronic diseases, sometimes 4, 5, 6 chronic diseases that are very expensive to treat, you can understand why, as a nation, we spend nearly $300+ billion on patients who have obesity and associated medical conditions. And so it's a national financial concern, but also on an individual level, it's an expensive disease to have. Now, in order to maintain adequate nutrition after surgery, you bring up a good point. There are responsibilities, and that includes taking supplements for the rest of your life. Mm. And we see patients from all walks of life, some of them who come from disadvantaged backgrounds. And they simply struggle occasionally to find the money to pay for these supplements, which can be $30, $40, $50 a month, which can be excessive in their budget. And so this is one of the areas that we look into when we're evaluating patients from every possible sphere to make sure that we don't give them an operation that they can't support. It's one of the factors that we contemplate about.
I think those costs, if I were to take my supplements plus my protein plus the calcium, if I added it all together, it's probably $5 a day, roughly. Depends on how much protein I'm consumed that way. Mm-hmm. The protein's expensive, too. So it's about $5 a day out of pocket per person. But that's just my own personal experience. Doesn't sound like a lot at first, but it adds up.
It adds up. And this is why our dietitians are so good at helping patients. First of all, they try their best to explain to the patients that let's try and get as much of the protein that you need from natural food rather than from supplements. And then trying to find less expensive yet still effective types of vitamins and other supplements that they need. Most patients, after the first year or so, shouldn't be needing to take daily protein supplements. they should be able to get as much as they need from their natural food.
Interesting. My experience with primary care physicians is there's a real reluctance to have a serious conversation about weight and about morbid obesity, in my case, and about the comorbidities and the likelihood of an early death as a result of that. And then I read recently, I forget which article it was in, that there's a calculation between the numbers of, between obesity and the numbers of years that you will lose on the end of your life, averages. But I've been seeing that. I'm wondering how does a primary care physician engage a patient? How does a patient engage a primary care physician? How does somebody, in my case, morbidly obese, actually get in the door to somebody like you? Right. That was a struggle. I found that to be a struggle. I was lucky. My primary care doctor thought about it as an option, but honestly, it was luck.
First of all, you brought up the life expectancy phenomenon that we've known about in this field, and it's true that patients who suffer from metabolic syndrome and morbid obesity tend to live shorter lives. Plus, to add insult to injury, less quality of life as well. And unfortunately, it hits the minorities more than others, meaning we've calculated that African-American men who are morbidly obese tend to live 18 to 20 years less than their lean counterparts. That's a wow. Huge amount. And it also, unfortunately, hits Hispanics to a larger degree than Caucasians. But you bring up a very important point that we've all been struggling with, and that is how to improve the ability of referring physicians or practitioners to broach the subject, first of all, and then how to make a referral to bariatric surgery. And to be a little blunt, I think that many providers are simply not adequately trained in this area. They don't receive any formal training on how to open the subject of let's talk about your weight kind of issues. And they might not be completely aware of the options that are available and the safety of the therapeutic options that are available. Or they might have some misconceptions or misgivings about bariatric surgery and not really be aware of how safe and durable it can be. In fact, we keep reminding providers that bariatric surgery is as safe as natural childbirth. Now, granted, it did have a checkered history in the past, but through our multidisciplinary approach, through our evaluation process, through our optimization processes, we've been able to reduce the incidence of negative outcomes down to very minimal levels. Plus, we mustn't forget the real-world circumstances. If you're a primary care physician or a primary care provider and you've only got 10, 15 minutes to see a patient and you've already have to discuss all their other comorbidities, how to maintain their diabetes, how to improve their sleep apnea, how to improve their hypertension, you really don't have a lot of time to talk about, well, let's talk about the underlying issue that's causing all these problems. And that takes, you can't rush this. You can't just simply tell a patient to, you know, remember to eat less and move more. It's not going to work. And so I think there are all these factors that are playing a role in the lack of increased adoption of the very successful, very therapeutic options that we can offer patients.
Is what message would you give referring physicians? What message would you give other healthcare providers who might have first contact with a patient, how would you help the provider get that patient to where they need to be in their metabolic journey?
That is a great question. We completely realize that providers in the community are very busy. They have long lists of patients that they have to go through, and they simply don't have the ability to spend a whole lot of time advising the patients on how to reverse some of the trends that they're seeing. And so what we advise referring physicians to do is send us these patients. As soon as they identify a patient whose BMI is above 35 or 40, and as soon as they realize that this patient is interested in seeking reversal of these trends, who has a certain level of motivation, send them to us, and we'll take it from there. We will evaluate the patients in a multidisciplinary fashion, and we will present them with all the portfolio of options that we have, and then take it from there and spend a lot of time explaining why they're in the situation they're in and how we as a group can help them. I think the most important message is don't delay, because the longer that they try to, okay, let's try a diet, or let's try sending you to the gym, or let's try having you see a psychologist, all these attempts at addressing the topic in a sequential manner, all it does is it offers these options to the patients in an isolated way, not a concerted, multidisciplinary, integrated fashion. And meanwhile, their medical conditions are advancing at a relentless rate, and they're getting sicker. Their diabetes is getting worse. Their hypertension is getting worse. The sleep apnea is getting worse. Their cholesterol, and so on. So the sooner we address these issues and reverse them, the higher the chance of success, and also the less risk of any complications. So we get much more positive outcomes when the patients are sent to us at an early stage.
I'm trying to imagine a scenario where a physician is engaging a patient about morbid obesity. And I can't imagine that mine was like other people's or that it was vastly different, but I think I'm the one that drove that conversation as the patient. As good as my doctor was, he wasn't really comfortable with the idea of telling me in no uncertain terms that the reason I'm experiencing all these things is I'm morbidly obese. How does a physician have that conversation without alienating the patient, without driving them out the door?
I think the best way to do it is to rely on the evidence and explain to the patient that the evidence shows that bariatric surgery is safe and effective as long as you go to a reputable program that has the resources and the support staff to help optimize the patient and educate the patient. Unfortunately, there's still a lot of bias, discrimination, not only amongst ourselves as providers, but in the population at large. And bariatric surgery, as I mentioned, did have a checkered history, which has markedly improved now. But I think what many referring providers are worried about is that they're not very clear about the potential problems that might happen down the line. And I've heard from some of them say that they don't want to necessarily have to take care of the complications that might happen from bariatric surgery, whether it's technical complications or whether it's nutritional deficiencies. And so what we need to do is reassure the referring physicians that we will take care of any complications should they happen. That they will not have to worry about it. We will work in concert with them, but we will certainly be the primary managers, if you will, of getting the patient back and rescuing them from any complication.
Is that helping the primary care physicians make referrals more frequently, helping them identify what referrals they should be making? Or are you seeing improvements in that area?
Yeah, we're seeing improvements from we have repeat providers, if you will. Mm-hmm. These are providers who've referred patients to us and have witnessed the beneficial effects. So obviously they are encouraged to send us more and more. And there are others who, as I said, have had long-held views about the negative potential effects. And so those are the ones that we try to reach out to and try to explain that it is safe, it is effective, and that we will take care of any issues that might happen. And hopefully we will be able to change their mindset, because these patients deserve to be. The other issue that might be concerning to them is that they don't necessarily want to be the ones instigating surgery to the patient. As you know, in medical school, I can tell you, we were always trained that surgery is usually the option of last resort. So you gave an example of acid reflux in the past, and usually the way we were trained is to treat acid reflux incrementally. In a staged approach, we start off by modification of the diet. Then, if that doesn't work, well, let's change the way we sleep and lift the head of the bed. If that doesn't work, try some medications. If that doesn't work, use more medications. If that doesn't work, then consider surgery. And I think a lot of our providers follow that same kind of mentality towards morbid obesity, not recognizing that the longer they wait before referring them to us, the worse the situation becomes. And so what I'd like to do is reassure referring providers is that send the patients to us. It doesn't mean that they're going to receive surgery 100% of the time, but we'll be able to evaluate and decide as a joint decision with the patient on what is the most appropriate treatment for them.
In addition to the American College, if there's an organization that is looking at the other issues around this treatment and around obesity generally, are there other resources that people can tap into?
Yes. So there's an organization called the Obesity Society. And this is a society of obesity medicine experts who are both academicians and who are community physicians, who try to learn more about the underlying disease processes and how all the different treatments can help reverse obesity. There's also another society called the OMA, the Obesity Medicine Association. And this is a society more commonly of community physicians and providers who deal with patients with obesity and do a lot of weight management in a comprehensive fashion. And the third, it's less accessible to the population. It's the ABOM, the American Board of Obesity Medicine. And this is the board of it's an organization that creates and holds high-stakes exams to provide physicians with the qualifications to be obesity medicine experts.
When you're talking to...
And of course, there's ASMBS. I should have mentioned that as well. It's a Society for Metabolic and Bariatric Surgeons.
Excellent, and that will give providers more resources to look at. Is there a way to help get past some of their biases around the error rates or the complications of bariatric surgery of old? How do we let them know that it's safe? How do we get that message out? I think if 2% of the population who need treatment. If only 2% are getting to you, what are we doing about the other half of the nation? I mean, there's a huge gap.
So it's a two-pronged, task that we have to do. One is to inform the lay population about the merits of bariatric surgery and how safe it has become, and at the same time inform them of the dangers of not doing anything about metabolic syndrome and allowing the disease processes to continue unabated. That is based on the assumption that these patients, once they become armed with this information, will go to their providers and say, hey, I'd like to talk to you about referring me for bariatric surgery. And the other prong, if you will, the other approach is to directly address providers and inform them of the benefits of bariatric surgery and its safety and how the ease of referring patients and how we will take these patients and evaluate them in a comprehensive, holistic manner. I think the best way for that is through CME kind of educational events, through periodic connections and encounters with providers through their societies, maybe special sessions in all their annual meetings, and the other organizations that might help. I can tell you in our situation, we have an annual CME event that is geared for referring providers. It's a symposium that we have. It's a whole day symposium where we address all the different aspects of metabolic syndrome and weight management. And it's well attended, and we should be doing that across the country.
And that impacts both the local providers and at a national level. You're bringing in national speakers. Yeah. I'm guessing.
Well, our first one we didn't, but we're planning to do this next year.
Well, if you're there, there's an international speaker there.
But. It is available what we call hybrid fashion. It's available in person and online as well, so it can be viewed by anyone anywhere in the planet.
If you could think of a number of CME projects or programs that you'd like to see out there, what would they be?
Well, really, we want to help as many deserving patients as possible. So any CME events that will break down, you know, tear down barriers for these eligible patients to receive our life-saving treatments would be very welcome. And if the problem with them reaching us is that referring providers are hesitant, reluctant, or probably have misconceptions about the options that we offer, then we would like to rectify that. So I think CME events that are geared towards the referring physicians, the referring providers, and giving them the information that they need would be very beneficial for our patients.
It's difficult. I can only imagine that it's difficult for them to engage in a conversation. For a physician to sit down and say to someone, and no matter what language we use, but you're fat and it's causing you a lot of problems. You got to confront that. And if you don't confront that, you're not going to fix this. That conversation cannot be easy under the best of circumstances. I think that I was so sick and tired of being sick and tired. I needed that conversation. I needed somebody to say, hey, you know, you're looking at this in little pieces. Step back and take a look at the fact that you are now obese. And I do want to ask you to make some distinction between what's overweight, what's obese, what's morbidly obese, where that comes in. Is that all tied back to BMI? Is that you know it when you see it? I mean, where does that come from?
So to answer the question about the different degrees overweight, it is a spectrum, and. Overweight, obese, morbidly obese, they're all different categories of the degree of obesity. Where we come in as experts in this area is in treating the patient with obesity, which is BMI of 30 and above. And for surgeons, it's 35 and above. But at any rate, I think you were fortunate that you were being treated by an enlightened physician who knew the dangers of remaining where you are and the benefits of seeking advice and expertise in this area. And I just wish that more referring providers really understood what it is that we offer and how we do it and how we help patients regain control of their lives, if you will, and reverse a lot of these disease processes, primarily by reducing hunger. And we've accumulated mountains of evidence to support what we do. And I just wish referring providers would be more intimate with that information and take it to heart.
Is there a do you find your personal style, or personal approach to patient interaction is how does that translate into the practice of into your practice?
Yeah, the first thing we do is obviously establish a good relationship with the patient, one of trust and confidence. And so, I always start by letting the patients know that I know how they feel and all the frustration and all the challenges that they've lived through. I also remind them that none of this is their fault, that nobody wanted to be this way, that it's a disease process, and that I'm going to treat them just like anyone who's had a disease through science and through expertise and my partners and support staff. And that's what I do to gain confidence, because I could be the best surgeon in the world, but if the patient is not really motivated or not really convinced that this is what they want to do, whatever I do is going to fail. So the patients have to become motivated, wanting to make a change, but at the same time understanding that this is a disease and it needs to be treated.
And that brings up a very interesting point. Surgeons are usually the captain of the ship, so to speak. There's a certain job requirement to managing a team that way. In this particular environment, you're having to step back and let other people take the lead at different places in the patient's journey, in their metabolic journey. How is that for you? How's that going?
Oh, I love it. I mean, I'm not an expert in every area. So the important thing is to work with people who share the same values and the same vision, and who also share the same understanding that this is a disease process that we're treating and that it's not the patient's fault and that we have to support the patient through the dramatic transformations that they're going to go through. And if you have the right people in the right places, then it works out fine, and I can sit back and let them take care of it and derive as much satisfaction and joy as I do.
Well, Dr. Mattar, thank you very much. I really appreciate it. I appreciate it, your time. I appreciate your passion for this, and I appreciate your mission. If not for people like you, I would not be healthy. And my future would be about as bleak as it was before, or worse, because like compounding interest, obesity doesn't get better over time. It just keeps adding to illnesses and comorbidities. Thank you so much for your time. Thank you for your expertise. Thank you for participating in this. If there are any additional thoughts you have, please reach out. Let us know. If there are things that I should have asked that I failed to ask, please just let me know. And I'm happy to rectify that. It's a pleasure spending time with you. And it's also a pleasure being your patient. So thank you also for that. And thank you very much for today. I appreciate it.
Thank you, Rob, very much for this wonderful opportunity. Thank you for the wide-ranging conversation and topics that we discussed. Thank you for being my patient and entrusting me. And I have to say, you're a very easy and great patient to have. And thank you for doing this whole podcast and for reaching out to providers. And hopefully I will be able to encourage more patients, deserving patients, to reach enjoy these life-saving measures that we have.
I think because of people like you, it's my mission now too, in my own way. So thank you.
Thank you very much.
Thank you for spending your time tuning into this episode of Reset Diabesity. I hope that you found it to be of use in your continuing diabetes education. We'd like to thank Medtronic for the unrestricted educational grant and to encourage you to visit our website or the show notes wherever you get your podcasts for more information. Please feel free to send us questions, comments, or show ideas you may have for future Reset Diabesity episodes. I'm your host, Dr. Rob Johnston, and thank you again for listening. This episode is accredited for continuing medical education by CineMed. Please view the accreditation information in the show notes. After listening to the episode, click the link provided in the accreditation portion of the show notes to obtain your CME. The content of this podcast includes opinions of the participants and are not to be construed as medical advice. Always consult your own physician for medical guidance.